You're listening to Many Lumens, where we talk about and find meaning in the intersections of art, social change, and popular culture. I'm your host, Mayori Carmel Holmes. In this episode, I speak with the writer and poet, Jason Reynolds, who posits literature as a form of radical world-making. We talk about our kindred experiences in the late 1990s, DC spoken word scene, our hippie parents, his love of Queen Latifah, and not so secretly, 90 Day Fiancé.
Well, welcome, Jason. Welcome to the third episode of Many Lumens, which is this new experiment of mine. And I really appreciate you being on here, being our first non-filmmaker guest. So
it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I know that you love film and your work is so closely integral to film and so many other visual projects. So it's not really breaking the rules, but I was really just looking for an excuse to talk to you.
on air, on record, because you can call me whenever you want me.
So this is the brief Jason Reynolds biography. The Washingtonian called you the bard of Black young adult fiction. You are a New York Times bestselling author of 14 books, most deemed for young adults, but I know a lot of old adults like myself who read your work. You are a two-time National Book Award finalist, Newbery Honor and Kirkus Prize recipient, NAACP Image Award winner, and the 2020 to 2021 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. You wrote Marvel Comics' first novelization of a POC Spider-Man, Miles Morales, in 2017. Your work has been adapted into a play, and this is all in 6 years. Am I missing anything?
Nothing that I want to mention. That's enough.
You are like the James Brown of, I don't even know if it's just YA fiction. I feel like of fiction.
Yo, I am, in any other category, in any other sphere or any other context, I would be considered obsessive. Like, that's really what it is, right? Is that I have, there's something in me that is motorized in a way that has propelled me to success, but is also tearing me apart in other ways. You know what I mean? So the bio is dope and it's super like impressive, but it comes at a cost for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is I don't want to say the end game because we can't think about our lives and like that, but this particular phase that you're in, when do you see sort of calming down a bit?
Yeah. I don't know. I thought it would calm down this year. I thought it would calm down last year, actually. But I like to live in the deep water. And if art and the things that I'm making aren't challenging to me, then I won't do it. Right. So like the art itself, whatever I'm working on, has to be difficult. But then in the difficulty comes the making of something interesting, and then the making of that thing, because of my success, gets pushed to the forefront, right? So now that's the way it works, right? Now, because of success, whatever you make is going to get pushed to the forefront. And because I'm really anal about everything and I work really hard to make sure that whatever I'm producing is solid, then it exists in this interesting space. And then there's more things that I have to do to manage that space, right? So it's a never ending cycle. I thought being the ambassador would be a little less work. And it turned out to be a lot more. I thought doing a nonfiction book about race would kind of come and go. I thought it was going to be like, yo, I'm going to enter this into the space as like something that maybe just the kids could read in school as an offset to the nonsense history books, right? And that's going to be that.
Do some gigs in February.
And then it became a much bigger thing, right? And right now, I'm working on something completely different than all of these things. And my fear, my hope is that it becomes a big thing, but my fear is that it'll become a big thing. Mm. And that's life, you know. But the end game is I don't know. I'm going to age out, right? So like that's the one guarantee, is that there's going to come a day where the distance between me and these kids that I write for, like the delta will be too wide and it's going to be harder to connect. And then I'll know hopefully I've done my job and have raised up a crop of young writers to take over, and I can kind of move on and do something else.
Yeah. You know, work really hard. You are on the road a lot, right? And I know for myself, I probably have a quarter of the work that you do. And I have been grounded in a way that I have never been grounded probably since eighth grade. And so I'm wondering for you, what is it like to be at home for these past 7 months, not on the road? I know you've been finding novel ways to still connect with your audience, but what is it like to be in the same place? Like, what has shifted for you in your practice?
A few things. I mean, at the beginning of it, I was so happy, you know, as somebody who lives in airports and in hotels, you know, it was so nice. I mean, I acquired this home to be a sanctuary, right? I built this place to be a sanctuary for myself, and I never got to really utilize it as such. And so to be able to have this space, and honestly, I couldn't even complain about quarantine, because we're not all quarantining the same. It has not been an equalizer, right? It's been more of an examination as to how inequitable things really are. And so for me, as somebody who is fortunate and who is privileged in that way, economically, it's been lovely to be in this incubator that I've built, right? That being said, we're on month number 7. And so much of my, and most of us as artists, so much of our lives is all about the filtering of our experiences through a creative lens. But I ain't having no experiences. Mm-hmm. I'm in the crib. Like, and when I step outside, it's usually to like run to the store or like, you know, I'm talking to my mother from the outside of her house, like all this weird stuff that we all have to do right now. And I realized that so much of my life is about like the interaction with humans and then taking that interaction and distilling it, right? And sort of like synthesizing it and then pushing it through this interesting filter. Even though my house is surrounded by all these things that are feeding my creativity, they don't work if I don't have external stimuli to bounce off of them. And so I've had to go and rent an office outside the house. I can't, even though we're like, this is being filmed in my office, right? And I haven't been able to really work in here since the quarantine or after the first 3 months. Because this isn't like my space was supposed to be like a space that I would want to like come to. I live here. And then when I'm not traveling, I have this space to come to this and there, but being forced to stay in here has turned this into a prison. And so I rented an office and I go there and lock myself in that space. And it works better for me to be outside the house, to get dressed, get up, take a shower, get dressed, get out the house. Even though I'm going just to the office and sit in there for 5 or 6 hours. So it's complicated.
So this is a fun question. What did baby Jason want to do?
It's interesting, right? Because I don't know if baby Jason knew. I think, well, here's what I'll say. I mean, look, there were moments in my life when I was really young, I wanted to be an acrobat because I thought that there was nothing cooler than people who could do backflips, right? Like, I just thought that was like magic. And then there were moments where I wanted to be an astronaut because when you learn about astronauts as a kid, they feel like real life superheroes, right? It's like, whoa, they get on rocket ships and they exist in a place that we can't see, right? And then there was a moment where I wanted to be a psychologist. And that was because I had learned that my father was a psychologist. And it was like, well, he's a psychologist. And my father studied hypnosis, right? Like, which was also interesting to grow up. I grew up in like a really strange, I think we've talked about this before. Like, I grew up in like a super liberal, weird, hippy-dippy household. And my father would look at my mother as if she was all like woo-woo. Because my mom was like, you know, my mom was on like the crystals and all of that in like the 80s, you know what I'm saying? And Same. Sage and Palo Santo and all of this that we're doing now that we think is all new. My mom is like, yo, we've been doing that in the house. And my father always looked at her as like a little bit left of center. Meanwhile, he was studying hypnosis, right? And so, and like practicing on his kids and like, you know what I'm saying? And so I wanted to be a psychologist. I thought he was the coolest dude in the world. So I wanted to be a psychologist for a moment. And then I found poetry when I was 10. And that was it, right? Once I once I understood that there was a way to manipulate language, right? Like that there's a, I mean, look, Mayuri, and this is what I think about it truly. I believe that I have 26 letters to put into a multitude of arrangement to cast a spell amongst humans. Like, it's the wildest form of alchemy, right? Other than music. It's the wildest form of alchemy, right? All I have is these 26 letters, and my job is to sort of put them in an order to make them do something to the human psyche. And there's something about that to this day, right? At 36, having worked in this industry for 15 years, having been writing since I was 10, 11 years old, it still overwhelms me. The idea of the possibilities that I have with just these 26 characters, right? Like, it overwhelms me to think about it daily. I'm like, I cannot believe that I get to every day figure out how to move these letters around to move human beings to the left or to the right, right? And that's all I really needed to know. And after that, I knew then at 10 years old, I was like, I know whatever it is I'm going to do, it's got to be something with this language.
That's really beautiful. I take writing for granted, and it is not something I'm proud of, but I really respect that. I'm gonna be thinking about it. I read in different bios and different interviews that you didn't read a novel cover to cover until you were 17. But I don't think I've seen, what was that novel?
Black Boy, Richard Wright.
Okay.
Richard Wright. And you know, it wasn't even, I mean, look, I love the novel. He was a complicated man, but I did love the novel because of the pace. It had nothing to do. It was about the pace, right? Like, you, when you look back at school, a lot of it is just these 50-page expositions. It's like, this is boring. When is the good part going to happen? But in Black Boy, it was like page number two, he burns the house down. And I was like, word up. Like, you know what I mean? Like, basic, right? Just real. and that was it for me at 17, almost 18, 17 and a half, yeah.
So there's this other piece that I read about your mother publishing your first poem, or not your first poem, but your first publishing in the memorial program for your grandmother, which I think is such a beautiful affirmation. And I wanted to know what or whom gave you permission to consider yourself a writer?
I don't think I ever asked for it. I think, you know, I come from a family. My mother, man, talk about a lady. I think there was never a moment in my life where I felt like I was less than, or that I had to ask permission to be whatever or whoever I wanted to be because of the way we were raised, right? My mom made it very clear that we were whole, that we were whole, even when we were young. You know, I was raised in a house where I couldn't go to bed at night unless my mother heard me say out loud that I could do anything. And she made me believe that everything I touch turns to gold. Not that that would come without work, right? But that I'm up for it. That I was built for that work, right? And that if it's something that I want to be or want to do or want to see, all those things are tangible. Nothing is out of bounds, right? She made sure that that my voice was heard. I always tell people I lived in a house where we could talk back. You know, if my mother said something that we disagreed with, I could say I disagree. I could say I think you're wrong. I could say I think you're being mean. I don't know if you got to cuss at me, right? Like, because I grew up in that kind of household. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there were moments where she said, Jason, honestly, I hear you, but you're still in trouble. And there were other moments where she would say, you know what, kid? I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I've had a long day. You know what I mean? And that's not your fault, you know? And when I wanted to talk back, she made sure that we had to be confident in our argument. So it's like, if you got something you want to say to me, then you better stick your chest out and you better hold your square. If not, I'm not going to take you seriously. I want to be able to hear you from the other side of the room. If you really got something that you disagree with, you better make it clear and don't leave nothing up to, you know, nothing can be left up to debate. Like, make sure I know how you feel and make it clear and let me know that you're confident in that standing and I'll let you rock. Right. And what she was teaching us wasn't just confidence, and it wasn't just that we all had voices, but she also was trying to get us to understand that if we weren't afraid to publicly speak our opinions, then we'd have the edge on 90% of the world.
Yeah.
Because everybody's greatest fear is that.
Yeah.
And so she's kind of like, if I could teach y'all how to speak publicly, and a whole and to really get up there and just do your thing and not care, just really hold it down publicly, then you're gonna have a leg up. No matter what you about to get into, you're gonna have a leg up because can't nobody do it, right? So she, my mom was like a mastermind when it came to the way she raised us, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes for the worse, but yeah. mostly for the best.
You know? I know my mother used to say, I don't know who told you to be so smart, you know, like when she didn't want to hear it, but I understand that. So I think like many of us, we're almost around the same age. You started with hip hop and with rap, and I read that you take some of that into your, I think, early cultural formation. So I wanted to ask you, who is your favorite MC? And if you can't name one, who are your top five?
Oof. I mean, like, it's such, you know, we gotta stop doing this, right? Like, top five is like, because it's like, I can tell you who my top five are right now. I can tell you who my top five were back then. I can tell you, right? I
mean, how about top five right now?
Top five right now. All right. I'm going with, I'm going with Black Thought. I'm going with, even though he ain't in the game anymore, Andre 3000. I gotta go with, it's interesting, right? Because there's a part of me that wants to say Kendrick, but I actually, as big of a Kendrick fan as I am, I just don't know if I would put him in my top five. Like, I don't know. Let's see. Thought. Yo, I love them Griselda boys, man. I love Conway. Like, I'm going to put him in my top five at the moment. Like, lyricists, because he's just nasty with it. And he make me feel like the 90s all over again, which I like, where it's a little bit, like, dangerous in a real way, where you're like, you might really be a killer. I kind of like that, you know what I mean? I still love Queen Latifah. Yo, I love Queen Latifah.
Really? I have never heard that answer, ever.
Yo, I think that Queen Latifah might be the most underrated Black woman in media, period. Mm. Honestly, I think if we were to really look at what she's done on paper, it's a travesty. It's a travesty that she isn't talked about. We're talking about someone who has changed herself and has really revolutionized many different sectors of this industry over and over again. We're talking about somebody who was cutting her own checks as a teenager. Mm-hmm. We're talking about somebody who tapped into television early as a rapper. We're talking about somebody who tapped into jazz as a rapper, movie productions. We're talking about talk shows. We're talking about makeup advertisement. Queen Latifah is a whole mogul and people don't be talking about her like she won. We're talking about cultural resets over and over and over again. And don't nobody ever say nothing. And she could bar everybody down still, right? So like, I got to put Latifah in there. And I don't know. Like I love Royce. I love Pun. I love like when Lauryn Hill was in her bag. Like, I mean, when nobody try and mess with Lauryn.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's so many just dope. I mean, look, I feel lucky to be Black just because I feel like I'd rather just be happy about it just because I'm like, we're not related, but we kind of are. And that makes me feel good.
You know, preparing for this interview, I was watching a number of your speeches and, of course, that recent video that you did for the 826 Project. And something occurred to me. I don't know if you saw Skip Gates, whatever that ancestry program is that he does. And, you know, Chris Rock realized that he had preachers in his lineage. And I feel like you must have preachers or hustlers somewhere in your lineage because your cadence is so, you know, just like, I want to do whatever you say, you know?
There's some hustlers in there, I'm sure. I'm sure. My daddy is a slick dude. He's one of these guys that my mother always talks about it. She's like, look, I married the bad boy because I couldn't help. There was nothing I could do. Right. He has just a way about him and he has a way of making everybody feel comfortable. Even though he can really tell you something wow, right? He gonna make sure you settle into the conversation and he's just a special dude. So I would probably attribute some of that to my old man for sure. He's an interesting he's an interesting cat. And, you know, I also think like that's some of that hip hop stuff too. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you coming up with when you coming up in that and you coming up with that, I just think in the same way that my father's friends and all of them came up with like jazz, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Or parts of the blues and how it affected who they were. I mean, when you look at Richard Roundtree as he's playing Shaft, it's just jazz and blues. Right. And maybe some funk. Right. But like he is the embodiment of those musical sort of moments. Right. And my father is totally that guy. Right. T-shirt, gold chains and like gold watch, diamond ring, motorcycles and fast cars. Like he grew up in that whole like, hey, this is how you do it. This is how you, it's lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Right. Which I think the jazz cats really showed us like lifestyle. This is lifestyle. And I think hip hop is the same way. You know, like it's all about sort of like confidence and swagger and knowing when to be loud and knowing when to be soft, knowing when to leave space for the music, you know, like all of these things, knowing when there needs to be a hook and knowing when there doesn't. And I think all of that is sort of the way that I sort of communicate naturally.
Mm-hmm. There was something else I was thinking about. So, of course, this is for the audience, but we became acquainted through our friend Rada Blank at Sundance in 2017. And I think it was for both of us our first Sundance. But I also love that since then we've realized that we were in the same rooms and along U Street in the late 90s, particularly at Bar None, the slam poetry era. And I was really young. I was like 19, 20. So you were like 15.
Yeah.
And what were you thinking you'd be doing now? What was 15-year-old Jason imagining 2020?
Oh, I was supposed to be Saul Williams. I thought, look, I was 15 sitting in the back of that club. They would let me sit in the back and because I was underage. And so I would just kind of hide out in the back of the club and watch everybody else get on a microphone. And you couldn't tell me that I wasn't. And you got to remember, and Slam. So Slam, the movie was out, right, just come out. Oh, my God. It was like a cult classic. And it was filmed in D.C. And so like all my friends are in the movie. Right. And we're watching it. And I mean, that was just my jam. And I just knew like, man, I'm going to be some kind of version of that, right? I'm going to figure out how to do this on Broadway, or I'm going to figure out how to do it before deaf poetry existed, because mm-hmm. it wasn't a thing yet. I'm going to figure out how to do this in an opera house. So, you know, I always try to figure out how can I take this thing that I love so much and make it something bigger. That's what I thought I'd be doing. I really had no intentions of ever becoming a novelist. I wanted to be a poet forever. Mm-hmm. And now I couldn't imagine being anything. It's so funny because now I'm like, I couldn't imagine getting on stage and reciting poems. Like, I couldn't imagine it. I'm grateful for it because it gave me some chops and it taught me a lot of different things. But I didn't think this was going to be my life, you know.
What was like your focus of, if you did have one in high school, what was your focus of study?
Oh, in high school, you know what? The wild part is in high school, this is what I was doing. Okay. So like in high school, I was a high school athlete. And which is interesting because I was like the athlete who also wrote poems.
And, which sports? What were you playing?
I ran track and I wrestled, you know, and I loved it, both of them. And but I was an art kid. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I dressed funny, according to everyone else. I wanted to write my poems and I would recite my poems at school, like for school assemblies. I'd be like, I want to read one of my poems and was totally with it. Like totally kind of like, I don't care what nobody say, and got the respect of so many of my classmates. Like, yo, JB, whatever that is, JB doing that. And we like it. We don't always understand it, but we rocking with them. You know what I mean? And I feel fortunate looking back now, because I really had a group of people around me, friends around me, who let me be whoever I was. Nobody tried to make me into who they wanted me to be, even though I was an athlete and all that other stuff. It was kind of like, nah, but he really just be on his art. He'd be really on his creative stuff. That's his jam. He really trying to be Andre 3000 out here.
Do you know anything about your astrology?
You know what? I keep forgetting to get my chart read because I keep forgetting to ask my mother about my time of birth. But I'm a Sag and I act like one. I know that for a fact.
You're definitely a Sag. Well, I was asking because I feel like you have Leo placements, and I'm so curious what your rising is, or just
Scorpio in there. I think somebody told me once there was some Scorpio, mm-hmm. and it might have been Leo. It was something else in there.
That's the thing that I pick up on, but I was just curious if you knew. I don't know much, but I like to play around.
I know what yours is.
Oh, your favorite sign. That's what
my
mine
favorite
is.
Sign.
I'm gonna make it your favorite sign. So I know that you collect art and rare books, and I was reading that you also collect watches. Are there any contemporary artists that you're currently obsessed with?
Oh yeah. Right now, who am I checking for? I just got a Deborah Roberts piece, which I did. You see that on Instagram?
I did.
I just got it. And I've been trying to get one of them for a long time. I asked her for a piece before she was famous, and then just ain't follow up with her and blew it. And then I had to pay, right? 4 years later, which was brutal. But I got a Deborah Roberts piece just now. I love Bumi Bodego, which is a young woman. She's out of New York at the moment. I want to say out of New York at the moment. And she does all her work with black hair. So I bought some of her stuff recently. Actually, you can see it in the screen. That's a piece of hers right there. And she just uses like black hair to make almost like paper.
Mm.
Like, it's pretty incredible. And I know black people got complicated relationship with like hair that is not attached to their heads, right? It's like once it come off your head, you're supposed to like flush it down the toilet or burn it or all the things. But she's kind of like, or we could like do what we really should do with it and turn it into something that is ceremonial and that is something that is like, that is art. It is something that should be praised and should be looked upon with adoration and admiration, right? Because it is the only thing, because it is genetic, it's DNA, right? And there's something about that is interesting. So I have a piece of hers. Of course, I love Bisa Butler stuff. I got an old piece of Bisa's, as most people know, that I'm so grateful for and I cherish because her work is so different than what it was back then. I mean, her name is actually, she used to sew her name into the fabric.
Mm.
And so like her name is on it, like, you know, stuff like that. And then there's some newer cats I'm checking for, like Jarrell Gibbs out of Baltimore. Young brother is a beast. And I'm looking at Yo-Yo Lander, who is does a lot of mosaic work, which is just brilliant, beautiful, beautiful stuff. I'm all like that. That's like my real jam. I'm all into like the arts, like visual art and all of that kind of stuff. And so I just discovered some sculpture. I want to figure out how to buy a piece of sculpture. It's so hard to find black people who make sculpture, but there are still some. And I found somebody recently, I can't remember the brother's name, but I'm going to try to see if I can reach out to him and get a sculpture. I don't know if I'm going to put it, but I'm going to get something. I'm just all about supporting this man. And I'm all about generational wealth. And I know, look, I could buy sneakers all day, or I could buy a piece of Bumi Bodego's work when she's 27 years old.
Mm-hmm. For whom do you make work?
This is a good question, you know, and it's a bit of a loaded question. Because I feel like so many of us say, like, I write for myself. And I just think that's ridiculous. Not because I think there's anything wrong with writing for self. I just think it's a fallacy. I think that I can't claim to write for kids and then when asked this question, say I write for me. Like, no, I write for kids. I write with them in my mind. Black children are at the forefront of my mind all the time when I'm sitting at the desk. Because in order for me to make something that actually represents them or that works or attaches itself to them, I have to have them in mind. It has to be intentional. And I try to move with intention, even when I'm making work. Now, does it feed me? Of course. And I mean that emotionally, right? Does it feed me emotionally and psychologically? Of course. Am I excavating parts of myself in the work? Yes, of course. There's no way that you can be a writer and not be dealing with self, right? Because in order to be a writer, one has to shut out all the other external voices and just be alone with self. So there's no way you can avoid dealing with yourself, right? So like all that stuff is there. But if the question is, who am I writing for? I'm writing for Black people. And in most contexts, specifically Black children, am I being changed in the midst of the process? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's sort of the best way I can answer that question.
No, I appreciate that. And I always like to ask that because I think sometimes even when people say they're writing for themselves, it's similar to the idea that, you know, even when we parent or take care of people, we're often thinking about how we want to be cared for. So I don't know that even saying you're writing for self is not also for Black children, right? Because it's the Black child in you, you know?
Exactly.
I was watching your Time 100 speech, and really love this idea about making work for young people of color, even the ones that aren't, you know, sort of safe to love or easy to love. And I really appreciate that. You talk about love a lot in other interviews and panels, love for your mother and particularly love for your friends growing up and the ones that are around you. Why is it so important to you to be uplifting this?
Yo, that's a wonderful, that's a good question. I mean, what else is there, right? Like, I think for me, I've been fortunate. I've been so fortunate. My friends, I grew up with the same, I had the same friends since I was like 4, 5. And I'm grateful for that because my life has changed so much over the last 10 years. And all of a sudden people treat me differently, but not them. Right? Not them. They don't treat me any differently. They still know Jay from, you know, us hanging out in the neighborhood and doing knucklehead stuff, throwing bottles in the street. You know, they still know Jason, who is insecure and has feelings of inadequacy and has terrible anxiety and leans on them for spaces of peace and comfort and as leveling rods. Right, like they steady me in a certain way because they know me, and they're non-judgmental, and we've never, you know, and you've heard, you know, Aaron, my day one, my
guy, Aaron Holmes,
he's a Holmes, right, my guy, and it's interesting because we've taken for granted that we grew up in a group of friends where you could be a boy and say you were scared. And nobody was going to make you feel bad. It was going to be like, oh, yeah, it's cool, man. Don't worry about it. Like, you don't have to do it. Or we'll all do it together, right? Or when all of our parents fell apart and our families broke down, to have each other there to say, like, I know how you feel, or you can tell me how you feel, or you can cry in front of me, and I'm not going to, like, make you feel small or judge you. You know, like, it's sometimes Aaron comes over to the house because I get emotional. Like, I am an emotional person. When you write stories, it comes with the territory. Like, everything that is narrative, especially as it pertains to humanity, makes me really emotional, right? So if I'm watching TV and it's a human story and there's anything that it could be anything, a small thing, I get so emotional, like, and I start to well up. And he could be sitting right next to me and pay it no mind. He'll let me, if the tears come out, he'll let me get myself together. He won't even acknowledge it. He'll, like, just keep reading the paper or looking at the show or... And that level of comfort is salvific. Like, that level of freedom, right? You talk about Black boy joy or free black man, right? I'm a free Black person, right? Mm-hmm. And that level of freedom is just that, right? It's freedom. It's freedom. And I will always be grateful for my friends and for my mother and for my father who kissed his boys, right? Kissed his boys, you know? He still kisses his boys at 70 years old. And that's what I made up.
In addition to those folks you just named, do you have a counsel that you lean upon or go to for critique?
For critique? You know what? I'm really weird about it. So I don't mind critique. I don't mind critique at all. But I just don't like people reading my stuff until it's like all the way there. You know what I mean? So I don't have like a writing group or anything like that. I can't do it. Like I writing is super solitary for me. So when my work is critiqued, it's critiqued by my editor. You know, like nobody sees it. Nobody reads my work before it's done. No one, except for her. And so she and I have a really tight and intimate relationship because she knows me and she knows what I'm trying to do. She knows my work. She knows my voice. She knows the way that I'm trying to, like, my process and the way that I think about literature is much like the way painters think about painting, where it's like, first you have your primer, right? Or first you have your stretcher bars, then you have your canvas, then you have your primer, then you have your first wash, right? Like, that's the way I think about it, like layer after layer after layer. And she knows that. So she knows what to look for underneath the text, right? Like subtext and context and all these other things. And so she's my person, right? Toni Morrison had her editor, right? It's like, this is my person and we kind of do this thing together. Now, personal critique, there's a lot of people around me that be like, Jay, get your shit together. You know what I mean? And all those people I'm really grateful for. And because that's what love sounds like to me. So I'm good with it.
You're listening to Mini Lumens, brought to you by Black Star.
This is Jason Reynolds, and you're listening to Many Lumens.
Another thing that we have in common is that you worked in retail clothing for some time. And that's the end of what we have in common. But also, you have a unique signature style, and I think particularly for an author. Did you ever envision that you'd be working in fashion? Was that ever on the table?
Yo, I never thought I would work. When I started working retail, I loved it. So, like, that's the thing, right? Like, I worked in retail in New York City, where it's a whole occupation. Like, it's a whole career, right? Because you meet, like, 40, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds. And I learned this when I was working retail. It's like, look, you know, you want to buy a $3,000 suit from a 60-year-old.
Right.
Not from a 19-year-old, right? Like, you know what, right? So somebody got to work that gig, right? And I knew brothers. I knew a brother whose name I won't say, but a brother who was working for Chloe, who was making $200,000 a year and working 3 days a week because he had clients, right? Like, it was just a whole different thing. And I loved it. I loved helping people feel good because that's what it was, right? And listening to their stories. When I first started working, I worked in an all-women shop. And so it was dope because I got to talk to women all day, and there's the obvious like, oh, there's that sort of like, there's always that weird sort of potential for sexual chemistry, right? And so there's that, but honestly, less about that and more about the fact that my whole life is just women, right? Like my whole family is women, right? I just prefer to be around women because I think that they are just better. Right. So because they're warm, and I feel fortunate to be around so many women who have no problem telling me when I'm wrong, and who also have no problem saying, come in, like, you're going through what you're going through. Like, I have a place for you here. Right. Both of those things. And I feel so grateful. And I try my best to make sure that those gifts aren't in vain. Right. And so, like, working in an all-women shop was dope for me because I like to communicate that way. And so it was cool to see women come in and leave feeling better about themselves, or to come in and try on a dress and say, what do you think of this? And try to sort that out and work with them. And then learning how to, like, pin and how to measure and how to tailor and all those things. So I could say, like, look, we can cinch it at the waist right here and really accent your figure. And we could do this, that, and the third. And you want something, you got a problem with your arms, we could figure out how to get you something with some sleeves. And even learning about all of these insecurities that I didn't know about and that I also have myself, right? So it was also some of that stuff happening. Like, I got my own body stuff and I got my own, I don't know. Like, it was wonderful. It was, I like to get fly. And we got all them clothes for almost free. Mm. So I had, like, you know, I'm like a young 25-year-old with a cashmere purple trench coat, right? And, like, spectator, like you know, cordovan leather spectator boots and, like, raw denim and cable knit sweaters that are made from some special kind of, like, yo, it was a leather jackets and, like, yo, listen, Mayori, I ain't got nothing bad to say about working retail except for the fact that it was a job. And I don't like working jobs. But other than that, that's it. That's the only issue. It was a whole job.
No, I totally appreciate that. I worked primarily in children's retail. And my last days were in this Dutch children's clothing store that they sold women's clothes too. But the children's is what made it the most enjoyable. One of the reasons I wanted to ask you about your retail experience and your style, or mention your style, because it's something I'm constantly in search of a uniform. And I'm not sure if we've talked about this. Mm. You have one, which I really, really respect. And I wanted to know how you settled upon it. I always think of you as this kind of, like, living, breathing, sort of a take on a literal character from Rockers almost. And it's like you're Lynton Kwesi Johnson and Mick Jagger in the same breath.
That's the highest compliment ever.
But how'd you settle on this look?
Yo, honestly, this is sort of a convergence of myself and my father. Yo, my father, if you saw photographs of my father at my age, he looks just like this. Mm. He wore, you know, jeans and boots and his knees cut out and a t-shirt. And he always had a gold chain or two around his neck. He always had on a wristwatch and he always had on a ring or two, bracelets. He always had long hair, always had a beard. And he always looked like at any given time, he could pick up a guitar. He looked like, right? So, like, he always looked like he wasn't what he was. My father was a psychologist, You know what I mean? Like, he was a doctor, but he always looked like he wasn't. He looked at, because he wasn't always a doctor. He was something else before that. He was a hustler, right? And so that was sort of his life, and that's sort of the way he always presented himself, as sort of a guy that looked like a rocker, where it was like, yo, you might be, you might be the dude that I want to be around, or that I don't want to be around. And there's something about that that I like. I like the ambiguity of it all. I like the mystique of it all. I like the fact that people are like, what is this deal? Like, what is it? Like, I just bought a pair of leather pants, right? Can't wait till they get here. I can't wait. And the crazy thing about it also is, the other thing that happened to me, honestly, is I started making money. When I started making money and I quit my job, I had to make practical decisions about how I was going to keep it. And so as somebody who loves to get dressed, because both of my parents love to get dressed, we were raised in a house to place value on the way you looked, right? That was a very big part of our childhood, of my childhood. I knew that if I was going to make smart decisions, I had to limit my options, right? So I said, all right, what can I do where I'm always appropriate? Because I'm also a fan. There's nothing I hate more than men specifically who are inappropriately dressed at the worst part. Everybody knows the man who's on a date and his lady got on, like, she dressed to the nine and he got on like his best Jordans. I hate it. I hate it. Like, I have a hard time. It's like, bro, grow up. Like, get a pair of shoes. Like, what is happening, right? Buy some boots. Like, get you, you know what I mean? Like,
get some leopard print boots like Jason Reynolds.
Get you some leopard print boots like the kid. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's my whole thing, right? Like, what if I could just, if I could limit my, I wear the same kind of jeans. I wear one brand of jeans, and that's the company that I used to work for, right? So I wear black jeans, fit one or fit two. I wear two different kinds of t-shirts from two different brands, right? And they're just plain black t-shirts.
Well.
They are plain.
I mean, okay.
It's a plain black t-shirt. It's plain black t-shirts. Mm-hmm. I wear jewelry from one place, right? So all of this comes from the one place. I wear sneakers from one brand. I only wear one brand of sneakers.
What can you say? What brand?
Golden Goose.
Okay.
That I've been wearing for years and years and years and years and years, when everybody was like, I can't believe you spent all that money on dirty shoes. I can't believe, when that was the whole thing. I've been wearing these shoes for years. I got like 40 pair, right? I wear one kind of boot for the most part, and it's Saint Laurent, right? Saint Laurent Chelsea boot or a Saint Laurent ring boot. I've got four or five or six pair, though. That's them leopard boots, right? I've got Saint Laurent boots. Like, I'm so like, but that's it. So it's like, I have my I don't have anything on right now, but I wear a vintage wristwatch.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. And if you saw pictures of my father, he looked just like this, with wristwatch, ring, necklaces, t-shirt, jeans, where it looks all played down, but it's really all played up.
You know? Well, I peeped game that it was played up, but I love that it, what I realized is like how light you travel.
Always.
You know, which is incredible. What is your process like when beginning your novels? Do you storyboard or outline your ideas, or do you free write?
I free write. I can't. You know, for somebody who didn't do that well in school, to outline is like doing work before you do the work. And I ain't trying to do double work. Like, I just ain't with it. You know what I mean? Even though I probably would be a more efficient writer if I did outline. But my honest theory behind it is, if it's not an adventure for me, it won't be an adventure for you. Mm. I don't need to know where it's going. I just want to go on this journey.
Where did you get your work ethic from?
That's my parents. That's my parents, and then I had a moment in college, well, just after college, that changed me as well. So my mother started working when she was 15. She took a job in the mailroom of a insurance company when she was 15 here in DC. And she stayed at that company until she was 55. Right? One job, right? From 15 to 55, my mom worked from the mailroom up to the executive office of an insurance company, and then retired, took a year off, and then became a school teacher and retired this year at 75, right? So we're talking about a person who has spent their entire lives just working. My father, who, though he was a hustler and doing all these odd jobs, it was always work. And then as a psychologist, I mean, the dude is just like psychologist. And then he also invested in a bingo hall and like he used to co-own a bingo hall and like all this other little side stuff, hustling. He had a divorce mediation private practice. He had, you know, just like, you know what I mean? Like, just like these, I come from working folk. Mm. Right. Working for and my mother, all them years of work, she ain't even touched no real money. So I'm talking about working folk who was working to survive.
Yeah.
And so the way that I was raised was, my father would say, when we would have to do chores and stuff, which we all hated, he would say, take pride in your work. Right. It was like a mantra. Right. Take pride in your work. Everything you do it as if your name going on it.
Yeah.
Everything. Right. You take pride in your work. And my mother raised this to be excuseless. Right. I tell people all the time, I come from waterless people, meaning I've never seen like my folks ain't emote when we were kids. Like, we, as much as they loved on us, and like I've never seen tears come out of my mother's eyes. I've never seen it was always about like, listen, we ain't got time. You have to get the things done. Right. And so she'd say, go outside and rake the leaves. We rake the leaves and the wind would blow our neighbor's leaves into the yard. And my mom would come back outside and say, y'all said that was done, but there's leaves in the yard. And we'd say, them ain't our leaves. Them the neighbor's leaves that blew over here. And she would say, son, let me explain something to you about life. It is none of your business what is happening in your neighbor's yard, nor is it any business of yours to even be concerned about what the wind might do. You have been tasked, right? And your job is to complete said task, period. The wind ain't an excuse, and what's happening next door ain't an excuse, right? So like the happenstance of life don't matter, and your environment don't matter. You got to get the thing done, right? And that's all I know.
My mother's version of that was finding joy in your work. You know, you got to bring some joy to whatever it is that you're doing.
That feels healthier. I wish I got to tell my mother that was a little healthier. I feel like that would have been better for us.
It was the same message. It was cloaked in that. It's been announced recently that you'll be writing a novel for adults, and I kept calling it an adult novel, realizing that that implied something else. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
The Mouthless God and Jesus Number Two.
Yeah, Mouthless God and Jesus Number Two. You know what? The crazy thing about the story is it's supposed to be for children. You know, I feel like...
Oh, is this one's for children?
No, it's for adults.
Oh, okay. But I thought it was.
It's for adults, okay. But it was supposed to be for children, mm-hmm. but I couldn't, it just wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And everybody I let read it, like I turned in the first, like, I don't know, I had written it, this is my fourth time writing this book. One time it was like 600 pages, one time it was like 130 pages. Like, I've just been kind of trying to rework it and figure it out. And every time I let people read it, like if I gave it to my agent or my editor, they're like, oh yeah, man, this is totally great, but definitely not for children, you know? And I'm like, what are y'all talking about? Like, this little boy, like 12, you know what I mean? And then finally, I let myself just go ahead and own the fact that this was an adult novel. And the basic premise is, I've been thinking a lot about epigenetics and this idea that, like, if epigenetics is a real thing, if we are certain that it is true, which we aren't yet, they're still sort of studying it and figuring out how it actually works, if it works, then what's to say that 100 years from now, Black children aren't born without mouths? What's to say that little Black girls and little Black boys aren't born with holes already in their bodies, if epigenetics is real, right? Like, to think about the evolution of the Black body, right? In the same way that men in general have no reason to have nipples now, right? That we don't have any biological reason to have nipples, right? And over the course of hundreds, thousands of years, right? We don't know what the quote-unquote male species was 5,000, 10,000 years ago. Maybe they needed them. Maybe they could breastfeed, right? Who knows, right? Mm-hmm. But to think about, what does that mean 5,000 years from now? That means that we'd have to also count slavery, right? So like all of that is a part of it, mm-hmm. because evolution, because it moves so slowly to us, but it's actually like 5,000 years ain't no time for the history of the world, right? And so what does it say 5,000 years from now, if there still is a world, Black children won't be born mouthless? And I wanted to imagine what that would be like. Not from the standpoint of suffering, though. Like, this little boy ain't suffering. He fine. Like, he chilling. But from the standpoint of how exactly does he live and survive? And he lives on stories, right? These are his mouths, right? His ears are his mouths. And he's satiated of the stories of his family. because that's really who we are anyway. That's the way it's working now. That's the way it's always worked, right? I am who I am because of what I know about my mother and my grandmother and my grandfather, because of what I know about my people. I get to stay in here because of what I know about them. And it's a story about how this young man acquires a mouth. He does get one, but the way he has to get one is interesting and is complicated. And it involves millions of other mouthless kids. And it involves, I mean, there's myth and there's lore and there's a little bit of everything in this thing. And this is an ambitious project. It is due soon and I ain't written much of it. And so we're going to see how it goes. But like I said, I live in the deep water. If it ain't hard, I ain't with it. I'm not interested in doing an easy thing. So we'll see.
When will it come out?
2022.
Okay.
Which means it's got to be turned in very soon so that we can go through the editorial process, go through, you know what I mean? Like, this thing is due in the next couple of months.
Okay.
And so I'm getting ready to disappear, hopefully, in December and vanish to get away and get it done.
You were recently in a project called For Everyone, which debuted on August 26th, 826 Day, marking a celebration of youth voices in the pursuit of dreams. What I was noticing in that video is that it was coming somewhat full circle because you were reciting a poem, right? You were having your Saul Williams moment for this short film. Do you see more poetry in your future or, you know, any kind of albums or recorded material?
Nah, I don't think so. I don't know. You know, I really want to write a collection of poems. I still love poetry, right? Like, I love anything that's word, like language. I love language. I wanted to write a collection of poems. You know that famous photograph, American Gothic?
Yes.
The famous photograph from Gordon Parks, a young Gordon Parks. This is Gordon Parks before he was famous, right? Mm-hmm. Young Gordon Parks working for the WPA, the only Black person assigned, the only Black photographer assigned to do this work in DC. Mm-hmm. And this woman, he went in to shoot a woman who was a charwoman, what they used to call a charwoman, who my grandmother was a charwoman. These are the women that would clean the government offices, right? So this woman was a custodian for USDA. And we've seen the photograph of her holding the mop, right? In front of the American flag. But we don't know nothing about her. And if you look at the whole photo set, I mean, Gordon Parks goes to her house, gets her story, like her husband had died, left her, but they don't say how, which is interesting, mm-hmm. left her with two kids or her daughter, a stepdaughter, a grandchild in this little teeny one bedroom apartment. They got her pictures of her at church. Just like a documentation of this woman's life, not just we only see her as a janitor, but there's a whole other part of her life that Gordon Parks explores that we don't ever get to see much of unless you can see the whole set. And I wanted to write a whole collection of poems about her, about who she might have been, right? You know, just sort of epistolary poems, not epistolary poems, ekphrastic poems about this artwork and these photographs, but also just imagining her life and imagining who she was or who she might have been or who she could have been if she weren't a Black American in this time. That's something on my list of things to do. We'll see.
I look forward to it. I'm sure that'll be summer 2022 after, because that's how you work.
Maybe. You might be right.
You can't just have one project coming out. You got to have four.
Yeah. We got this coming out. You seen this yet?
Yeah, I have. Congratulations.
Oh my God, it's good. Have you seen the images in it?
No.
It is gorgeous. It comes out soon. I don't know, like in a couple of weeks, I think. But
because this is a podcast, Jason is holding a graphic novelization of Long Way Down. Who's the illustrator again?
Her name is Danica Novgorodov. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm super grateful and proud of what she made.
How has your voice changed since your first book? And are you seeing a pattern at all in what you're writing about? Or how, you know, who your characters are. Is there a thread?
I mean, my voice changes every day, right? It's changing regularly. It's the reason why I write so much, because if I take too long on any given project, I got to start over because the voice has changed so much. Because I'm learning everything. I'm consuming, right? And with consumption comes influence. I think my voice is completely different, but I don't think my books feel different. And I like that. Like you could pick up a book, read it, and be like, this feels like a Jason. It's like Baldwin or Toni Morrison for that matter. You can pick up any of Toni Morrison's books. They're all different, but when you're reading it, you're like, this feels like Toni Morrison's writing, right? James Baldwin, right? These long sort of illustrative and ornate sentences. It's like, this feels like James Baldwin. This feel, right? And I think the rhythm of my work, I think I understand what I'm doing, not in terms of writing, but in terms of just me, like who I am on the page. I never know what I'm doing in terms of writing. I still don't feel that good. I'm working very hard to get better at this thing. But I do know what I offer the space mm-hmm. in terms of style, what my style is, what I offer the space. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful to just know, to be able to know, like I got a thing that I can put in these books and people that say, yo, that's that thing that Jason does. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like that's to me, that's wonderful. And what was the other question? Oh, the characters. I mean, is there a through line? Yeah, all the boys cry. All the boys cry. That was important for me. It still is. I want my young brothers to, you know, tell your secrets to the pages. Mm. That's all. You see, you reading it and you see yourself. And I know you don't always feel like you can do those things. So it's okay for you to sort of hide your secrets in those pages, right? And that's the reason why I create vulnerable boy characters all the time. I think it's important. So that's a through line in all of my books for sure. Just beautiful, like the beauty of blackness. I'm doing this thing now. I'm writing, you know, these are Captain Underpants books, right? These are like that weird space between the picture book and the middle grade. That's like first and second grade.
Yeah.
So I'm writing a series right now. I'm working on a series right now about a little black boy whose parents are going through divorce. And he lives in an apartment building. He got his home girl. It's called Stump Boy in the meantime. And I'm excited. I'm excited to see it. I'm excited to tap into a new space. It's super hard to write these things because they're only 3,000, 4,000 words. But even just thinking about, like, can I create enough of this work where I can have a reader read Jason Reynolds' books, a black boy or a black girl read Jason Reynolds from the age 1 to 18, right? And I'd probably be, there's not many of us who've ever done it this way, right? To say, like, you can read the whole canon all the way up through and then into the adult space.
Right.
That's my goal.
Is there a Jason Reynolds film or interior design practice in your future?
There is some film stuff for sure. I'm learning that and learning how to write that. And I've got some cool mentors, Joe and Paul, who are the guys who made Rugrats mm-hmm. and Hey Arnold and all those guys. They've agreed to kind of sit with me and really kind of, they're working on some other stuff with me. Look Both Ways they're doing that project for some folks. But they've been helpful, and because I don't believe in doing anything without mentorship. Mm-hmm. Like I just come from a certain, I believe in the tradition of things. And that sort of held me up when it came to this film thing, because people are like, just do it. It don't matter, bro. Just do it. And I'm like, man, that feels super disrespectful. Like I got too many friends who have been, Rada, right? Who's dedicated her life to this and finally got her swing. What I look like trying to skip the line? Like, I just don't believe in that personally. And you know, everybody got their own thing, but I'm just kind of like, yo, let me take the proper channels. Let me get some education. Let me get some OGs. Cause I believe when you see somebody come into a space, you check the person and say who you came through, like who were your OGs? And I just believe in that. So these brothers are helping me out. And so there will be some film stuff, interior design stuff, outside of my own home. Nah, I don't think so. I don't think so. I would love to someday, maybe when this is all over, I'll tap into some of that stuff.
I didn't know if you were going to get your Lenny Kravitz on, you know, and start designing furniture, you know.
Hey, man, I want to. I want to, for sure. But if I did it, I'd have to do it. I couldn't do it the Lenny Kravitz way. I'd have to do it the Daniel Day-Lewis way, where he just went on. He wanted to be a shoemaker, so he went to Italy and apprenticed with a cobbler, right?
Method, yes.
If it ain't like that, I'm not going to do it. I got it. That's just how I am. I just believe in that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So we're at the end.
We're not going to talk about movies.
Well, what do you...
All right, here's the thing. Have you been watching season 4 of Fargo? Because me and you talk about TV all the time, Ayori.
So,
why
Jason,
all of a sudden we on your show and we talk about TV all the time?
I know that's our personal lives. That's not the focus of this show. But if you want to talk about, I have not seen Fargo yet. I also haven't brought it up because I'm quite behind on everything. So I haven't seen Lovecraft Country. I haven't seen I May Destroy You. Like I am behind.
<But I too. laughs> What are you doing?
Oh, nothing.
All right. I'll let you off the hook. We'll talk about it later when you catch up.
What are you watching right now?
I'm watching Fargo. I'm watching Lovecraft. I watched this like barbecue contest show that was lit. I watched the new season of Chef's Table. Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
What about 90 Day Fiancé? You still watching that?
Of course. This was the reunion week. Yeah. Hey, listen, we all got to have a little junk food. We got to have some junk. Hey, like 90 Day Fiancé, despite the wild cultural politics that at some point should be parsed out, mm-hmm. there's actually some tricky stuff happening there.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, I mean, that's good TV. You know? And I've been watching like the Lakers play. Mm. And I've been watching, did you watch Perry Mason was dope? We haven't talked about this yet. Ratchet, was that other joint? Ratchet?
You seen that? Oh, Ratchet, Nurse Ratchet. No, so I mean, part of what's been going on with me is that, you know, I'm in a new apartment and I've been focusing on like just being really organized in the space. And then I've been working on a film project of my own. And I've been watching movies and reading. And so I haven't been watching serialized television as much as I'd like to, but I have been since the Emmys. I've gone back to Schitt's Creek and started with season one. So that's what I'm currently watching. And I can kind of only handle one show at a time. So when that's over, then I'll go down the list.
Have you seen Wendy yet? Did we talk about this?
Wendy? Mm-mm.
Like the remaking of Peter Pan. I'm obsessed. It's like, I've seen this movie 50 times.
I'm going to add this to the list. No.
It's on Apple.
Okay.
TV, whatever. But it's called Wendy. It's by the folks who did Beast of the Southern Wild.
Okay.
And it's like a retelling of Peter Pan. And I watched, when I was writing as I'm working on my adult novel, like that is my color palette, like my palette, right? Mm-hmm. That I'm looking at is like, that's my mood board. That whole movie is exactly what I'm trying to make. Like it's just check it out. Word. So good.
Well, I think this actually goes into the final question. You know, we started off, I think before we started recording, talking about how much you're working. And I get the sense that you are always taking care of people. Mm. And I have two questions for you. And one is, who is taking care of you? Mm. And how do you find refuge?
Who's taking care of me? Man, I think that's sort of the question. You know, it's a tough question to ask. I don't know. I do know this. I'm trying to go back to therapy because I just think I need that, you know what I mean? And I had a therapist, and I don't right now, but I'm looking for a new therapist. So I think that'll be helpful. And honestly, what I require is so small, so little. And so the small moments I have with my mom, just small moments, right? Nothing. My mom ain't got to do nothing for me ever again. But to sit down with her and to just sit in the room with her is refilling. Mm. You know, I'm going to see my father this Sunday. We're going to like smoke cigars and talk trash. And he'll ask me to buy him a gold watch because he always does. You know, like that's, you know, it's like, and I think that will be so good for me. I just don't need much. I'm not a person who likes to celebrate himself. I don't need all the noise and the hullabaloo and all the huzzas. I don't need all that. I just need for someone every night. Like, I mean, look, you check on me all the time. You know what I mean? That matters to me. These little small things that people say, hey, Jay, checking in. How you been? How you doing? That's enough, man. Because I think there's so many people in my life who it's like, what can we get from them? Take, 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 take. That the few people who do reach out and say, hey, man, just checking in. Or, hey, man, love you. Thinking about you. That goes a long way for me. In terms of my personal refuge, you know, I love a long drive. Like, that's my jam. Give me 6 hours on the road. You know what I mean? Let me drive to Charleston. Let me drive, you know what I mean? Like wherever. Let me drive to Boston. I don't care. I just want, there's something about the open road that I love with my music on or my podcast or some silence. I love that. I love a good walk, a long walk around the city. It's amazing. Like just, I'm simple in that way. I just don't require, you know, I live in D.C. where the Smithsonian is, you know, I go to the museum, bop around for a little bit, walk along the National Mall. It's beautiful down there and kind of recalibrate. And that's enough for me. A good meal I eat, you know, I love, as you know, I love a good fancy meal with a glass of rosé or, you know, a gin on the rocks by myself. Give me the newspaper or a good book and I'm good. I'm good. Like I'm super easy in that way, you know, and that's it. That's enough refuge for me. I'm good to go. And in Arizona, when I get a chance to travel again, I'm an Arizona guy. I love Arizona. That's like my
Sedona or just
not even Sedona. Yes. Sedona, of course. Flagstaff is dope. Mm. Tucson is dope. Like it's that the American Southwest in general is like a sweet spot for me. It's like a spiritual place for me for whatever reason. There's something about it that I gravitate toward. I love it. And the drive, when I bridge my two forms of refuge and drive from Los Angeles to Arizona or from Arizona to Los Angeles, I don't think there's a stretch of land in America more special that most of us don't take advantage of. What'd you say?
I said Route 66.
Yo, and most of us don't take advantage of how it's almost like a miracle that a place on earth could look like that.
Yeah.
And most of us just don't know. We just don't see it. We fly over it, or we, you know, and it's really, it does something to you chemically when you're driving through the red rocks and the sun, and the sky is big, right? And the land is brown, and there's cacti and a house every 6 miles and the reservation. It's like what America once was. And there's something about that that I don't know. It speaks to me. So,
well, I hope you get some of that refuge soon.
Thanks for having me on, homie.
Thank you.
Later.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Many Lumens. Visit us at manylumens.com to subscribe and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Many Lumens. Many Lumens is brought to you by Blackstar. This episode was produced by Patrice Worthy and Farah Rahaman, edited by David Adams, and engineered by Mike Mahalik. Our music supervisor is Rashid Zakat. Our theme song was composed by Vijay Mohan and remixed by David DJ Little Dave Adams. Sending you light, and see you next time.